Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, ecumenism and the Anglican patrimony. The Anglican Centre here in Rome hosts a colloquium exploring shared aspects of canon law. Healing memories. Catholic and Jewish leaders recall their painful past as they look to the future together. And five steps for applying ancient monastic wisdom to our frenetic modern lives. Preserving the Anglican patrimony within the Roman Catholic Church. That was one of the ambitious goals of the Ordinariate for former Anglican clergy and faithful, set up by Pope Benedict in November 2009, with the publication of an apostolic constitution entitled Anglicanorum Caetibus. According to that document, members of the Ordinariate may celebrate the sacraments and other liturgical events according to the Anglican tradition, so as to, quote, maintain their liturgical, spiritual and pastoral patrimony as a precious gift and as a treasure to be shared. But just what does that patrimony entail? How will it be understood by disaffected Anglicans moving over to Rome? And what effect will this have on the wider ecumenical landscape?
Extremely good question, and that's why I asked the Catholics what it is that they were actually talking about.
Canon David Richardson is the Archbishop of Canterbury's representative to the Vatican and director of the Anglican Centre here in Rome. Over the coming months, that centre will be hosting a series of encounters to explore the different legal, liturgical, spiritual and pastoral aspects of its patrimony, beginning with a colloquium on canon law on the afternoon of Friday, March the 4th.
The offer, the Ordinariate Anglicanorum Caetibus, talks about the gift to the Ordinariate of Anglican patrimony, but in a conversation that I had last year with some people from the Vatican, and I said, what do you mean by those things? They said, that's really up to you to tell us. So where the Anglican Centre is trying to explore what it does mean so that we can help them to understand what gifts, what patrimony Anglicans might bring as a piece of offering in this sort of receptive ecumenism model.
You're holding this first meeting on canon law. There is already a group of Anglicans and Catholic canon lawyers who meet and discuss exactly around this area, don't they? The differences and the way the two can perhaps work closer together.
Yes, there's a group of canonists that have been meeting for some considerable number of years now, and they meet annually and explore what's in common between Anglican and Roman Catholic canon law and what the divergences are and ways forward. In fact, last year we had a 2 or 3 day seminar on canon law in the service of the gospel here, but that was specifically an Anglican exploration, and Professor Mark Hill and Professor Norman Doe were the chief teachers in that, and they'll both be here again this time for the meeting of the colloquium, the canonist's colloquium, as well as for our colloquium while they're here.
And how does this fit into the bigger picture, as you see it, of the ecumenical dialogue? How will this help the two sides work closer together?
Well, one of the issues that's been around ever since the Anglicanorum Caetibus model was wheeled out is what precisely this patrimony is, particularly as probably many of the Anglicans who might think about joining the Roman Catholic Ordinariate would not be Anglicans who have been using Anglican liturgical forms for years. So it doesn't really appear as though those Anglicans are going to be taking liturgical patrimony across into the Ordinariate with them. So what precisely might they take? And, you know, what, as I say, what is the Anglican patrimony gift which is so highly valued and yet so little known.
If you're looking specifically at the aspects of canon law, how would you perhaps describe the differences between the two? What would you see as perhaps the starting point from both sides, if we can put it simply?
That's probably a question too far for me. Somebody said to me a year or so ago that under Henry VIII, the Anglican Church stopped having the right to write new canons, and it's taken until the discovery of Professor Norman Doe to get us back on track again. But in fact, what Norman and his team have done is to discover, an enormous amount in common between Anglican and Roman Catholic canon law, but also an enormous amount in common within the worldwide Anglican Communion about canon law. And there are various journals and books that have come out which explore that very thing, what is the Anglican practice of canon law around the world. And a little book was put out for the Lambeth Conference a couple of years ago exploring that sort of issue.
It's certainly probably not very well known around the world by most Anglicans themselves, is it, what this body of canon law might be?
No, it's not. And in fact, the interesting thing is, I think, that for most people, most Christians, churchgoers, canon law would seem to be an immensely dull topic and not worth exploring. I had, when I came here, getting towards 3 years ago, it suddenly impinged on me that canon law was actually going to be hugely important in the future of ecumenical dialogue, because it is concerned with the way churches practice pastorally, and therefore at the basis of our day-to-day life.
So this will be the first step then in a series of very interesting meetings, opening up perhaps this greater ecumenical heritage, if we can call it that. Tell us a little bit about the others that you have in mind.
Well, we later in the year, for example, the governors of the Anglican Centre will be here. One of the governors, indeed the chairman of the governors of the Anglican Centre, is Bishop Stephen Platten, the Bishop of Wakefield, who, when he's not doing his day job, is also the chairman of the Church of England Liturgy Commission. So I'm hoping round about that time later this year to have another colloquium on, for example, liturgical patrimony, which might be explored and part of this process. And I haven't got any particular dates or peoples yet lined up, but as they become available, I will watch this space, I think, is the right thing to say.
When people think of Anglican patrimony, a lot of them think of particularly the musical tradition that has developed over the past 500 years. How do you perhaps think that can be explored and explained and shared in some ways?
Well, I think that would make a fascinating colloquium, and probably it would be attached to, although it stands in its own right, but it could easily be attached to the colloquium on liturgy. And yes, I mean, that's an extremely good question, and that's why last year I asked the Catholics what it is that in the pastoral, liturgical and spiritual patrimony that they were actually talking about, and was invited to help them to discover what they were actually feeling for. And so I think this is a gift that the Anglican Centre can make.
Thanks there to Canon David Richardson, Director of the Anglican Centre here in Rome. A tour of a French internment camp and a Shoah Memorial Centre, a tree-planting ceremony for a young victim of anti-Semitic violence, and a chance to share faith and friendship with a local Jewish community. All these were on the agenda at a meeting in Paris of the International Catholic Jewish Liaison Committee, which concluded on March the 2nd. The theme of the meeting, held at the prestigious Collège des Bernardins, where Pope Benedict gave a key speech during his 2009 visit to Paris, was a review of 40 years of dialogue and a chance to look ahead to future perspectives. Despite ongoing tensions between the two sides, the joint visits to places of importance for the Jewish world are very practical and powerful symbols of the progress that has characterized Jewish-Catholic dialogue since the Second Vatican Council. That's according to Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity and a member of the high-profile Vatican delegation which travelled to Paris for this meeting. Bishop Brian Farrell, you're there in Paris attending this meeting with Jewish representatives from around the world. Tell us, first of all, what have been the most significant aspects of this meeting so far?
Well, this is the fourth such meeting that I have been at. The meetings began way back in 1970. The first meeting was held in 1971. And it seems to me that the first thing we have to say is that the climate of communication between Catholics and Jews here at the meeting is greatly improved, and that the sense of trust in this dialogue, which has not always been easy, is much improved.
You've been to visit some of the places of the Jewish community there in France, haven't you, including a synagogue? What can you tell us about that?
Yes, it was a visit to a synagogue in a suburb of Paris here in order for us all to understand the real situation in which the Jewish community lives its life. It is a very active community. And we were able to not only celebrate with them, but there was a planting of a tree in memory of a young Jewish boy who had been killed precisely because of anti-Semitic feelings and so forth some years ago. And we had then a really wonderful encounter with the local Jewish community, and heard about their life, the efforts they make to transmit their religious traditions, the kind of education they give to the younger generation and so forth. It was an insight into the life of this local Jewish community, which brought all of us who come from around the world into contact with the realities of living in a particular situation.
France, of course, has one of the most significant, sizable Jewish communities in Europe. How much are concerns about anti-Semitism still very much at the forefront today?
Well, it's present all over Europe, and unfortunately, it's something that no matter what the educational effort we make has not been completely eradicated. I think that we have continued to discuss this question, but I think also that people are pointing to the fact that there is progress, and that the way we present each other in our catechesis, in our understanding of history and so forth, has greatly improved. And of course, improvement means that there's a search for the truth rather than for the repetition of slogans and prejudices that can sometimes be the cause of tensions.
You're also visiting the Drancy internment camp, aren't you, from where thousands of Jews were deported to the death camps during the war. Yeah. It's a sign, I suppose, that history is very much a part of the present dialogue between the Catholic and Jewish world.
Yes, it is, of course. And history is part of all the relationships that we build between the Christian churches. The burden of history is very heavy on most peoples of Europe in particular, and we all have memories that are kept alive and that give a certain sense of identity. So here, too, of course, the terrible events of the Second World War, and especially of the Shoah, are very much a part of the identity of the people who have lost family members at that time and still keep a great veneration for them. It's really an experience. We, of course, are concerned with the spiritual realities behind all of these historical events, and it's a deep, moving experience to pray at these places, to remember the terrible evil that was done and how that evil still has its effects today. So together we visit and pray and commit ourselves to doing whatever is possible to make sure that the younger generations understand that we cannot be divided in such a way again. We cannot abandon one another, and that we have to stand together to be able to live in the truth about each other.
Paris has a very significant Shoah Memorial Center, doesn't it, with precisely this aim in mind?
Yes, yes. And, well, naturally, it was in the heart of the whole problem with the occupation during the Second World War and so on. But also, it stands today not so much to remember the past alone, but above all to make us aware that a different future has to be built.
The theme of your meeting is 40 years of dialogue, reflections on the past, yes, but also future perspectives. What could you tell us from this meeting about those future perspectives, the hopes for the coming years?
Well, of course, we evidently are all committed. We have had a continuous exchange in these meetings here about the ways in which the Second Vatican Council with Nostra Aetate has changed our relationship to the Jewish community, and how this relationship can no longer be left, you might say, to the kindness of our heart, but that it is an essential part of our understanding of our own identity as Christians, and that we must begin to understand each other at a deeper level. So on the one hand, there will be certainly a commitment to a deeper, more theological conversation between Catholics and Jews. But on the other hand, too, we realize that we have so many of the same values. And in society today, we can work together to defend these values and to cooperate in projects that will be of benefit to society because of the values that we stand for. And today there was an interesting discussion on bioethical questions, which showed also how many, many Jews are very close to the positions that, for example, the popes have taken in recent times on these matters.
There's also a number of interesting projects, aren't there, going on where Jews and Catholics are cooperating together. I'm thinking of things like the Caritas working together with similar Jewish organizations.
Absolutely, yes, yes, yes. And, of course, it varies in different places around the world. And it varies also according to the number of people in the Jewish community in different places. But, yes, and I think that one of the important things is that we recognize that there is a growing understanding that we must do these things together, yes.
My thanks there to Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, which oversees the Vatican's relations with the Jewish world. Five steps for finding sanctuary. Five phrases for easy meditation. And how to apply ancient monastic wisdom to our whirlwind modern lives. In a nutshell, that's what you'll get if you pick up a copy of Finding Sanctuary by Abbot Christopher Jamieson, the former head of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey in the south of England. And if that name sounds familiar, well, so it should, because he's the man who featured in the TV show The Monastery, watched by over 3 million viewers when it was first broadcast on BBC Two in May 2005. The three-part programme followed five ordinary men who spent 40 days inside the monastery, living alongside the monks and learning about the Benedictine spirituality which shapes their daily lives. It was so popular that a follow-up programme has since been produced, together with a similar show tracking four women's experiences in a Poor Clare's convent nearby. Father Christopher's book, meanwhile, has become something of a bestseller, snapped up by people with no apparent interest in religion and no contact with any Christian church. So what's the secret of his success? Or is he selling out the faith, as some fear, by simply cashing in on public interest in New Age spirituality?
Look, the basic expectation is that we now live in a society where most people say, I'm not religious. But the good news is that they usually preface it by saying, or they usually add to that, but I am spiritual. And we have to start to show how religion is at the service of spirituality without an agenda, but rather we have a religious offering to feed the spiritual life of the spiritual people of this country.
With that key concept in mind, Father Christopher helped set up a website to cope with the huge interest sparked by the monastery TV programmes, and then set about writing a book to make the monastic tradition more accessible to non-religious readers.
The book was a result of an invitation from the excellent publisher, Weidenfeld & Nicholson. They began rather charmingly by saying, look, we don't normally publish religious books, although we did publish the works of the late Pope John Paul II, which was rather encouraging. But they said, we feel there is a space in the market here for a book coming through secular outlets, which is actually a religious book. And this was really very interesting and returns to the earlier theme. They felt that the market was saturated with the new spirituality movements, with new age therapies, with all of that. We all know about that stuff, so to speak. But they felt the monastery showed that actually those same people who buy those books are now open to classic religious insights. They no longer have to be coming from a new age source. And therefore they asked me to write a book from the classic Catholic monastic tradition, which might speak to the situation of people today. And they said, please begin with where people are today and then show how the monastic tradition can enrich their spiritual lives and guide them on a path through that, as you did the people in the monastery. So I was thrilled to do that, and I learned a great deal about how to conduct this dialogue by an excellent editorial team who helped me to realise when I was using language that would not be accessible, and who helped me to understand what was going to be understood and what wasn't going to be understood. And that has been a great learning curve for me. When I'd finished the book, I was concerned by the question you asked earlier, have I actually dumbed down the tradition in some way? I was concerned about that. And so I sent it to a fellow abbot who is an incredibly able man who I've known for many, many years. In fact, knew him since I was we were both lay students together, and said to him, have I been faithful to the tradition? And he said, oh yes, he said, I want to read this book out in my refectory for all the monks to hear. It would do them good. So I was really encouraged by that.
So who would you personally say the book is aimed at? I mean, is it more for the monks in their monasteries, or is it more for people, is it also for people who know nothing about religious life,
no,
or indeed the church?
It's specifically aimed for lay people, not for religious or priests, and it's specifically aimed for non-religious lay people. It is clearly directed towards the person who says, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. That's the focus. Those are the people who've been buying it. I discovered that it's now being sold in W.H. Smith because people have been going into W.H. Smith, which is, people need to know, is our standard high street news agents here in Britain, and asking for the book. You know, that's the kind of popularity it's had.
With all this new media interest, where do you find time to keep up the running of the community at Worth as well, I wonder?
Well, one of the things I've discovered about the media is that, funnily enough, the media is not something that's deeply intrusive into the monastic life. Provided you treat the media with respect, they treat you with respect. And I say to them, well, I'll see you next week. It's not like a news agenda. If you had a big news agenda running, then it does become more complex and you're under pressure. But when you, in a sense, have a message to communicate, which they're interested in hearing, then I negotiate and say, well, I can do it next week, but not this week. And a small TV camera crew is not particularly intrusive. If we can reach 3 million people through the presence of a production team of two, then, you know, that's a pretty good ratio. It's a way of communicating the gospel through the monastic tradition in an unobtrusive way.
I've seen your approach sometimes described as Benedict Light. I mean, have you had criticism, serious criticism, from people who think that perhaps you're taking a too modern, if we can call it, approach to the faith, that there is a risk inherent in this kind of dialogue with the modern world?
I think there's two responses to that. The first one is, I think it's only Benedict Light if it's read quickly. I think if the book is read slowly and at depth, then the whole of the tradition is implicitly present within it. And that's why I was encouraged by the response of other monks to the book. Secondly, the accusation of selling the tradition short is one that is usually made of those who succeed in engaging a new audience. I think the Bible is full of such examples, including our Lord himself, who got into great trouble with those who said he seemed to be selling the tradition short.
Future projects? Do you have anything in the offing after such a successful past year?
Well, the BBC are very engaged now in a whole new raft of religious broadcasting. They believe that the monastery represents a turning point in religious broadcasting in this country. They're talking about taking the book, finding sanctuary, monastic steps of everyday life, and seeing what happens when they give that book to ordinary people out there and filming their attempt to live out those steps in their day-to-day life and making that into a new documentary. I think that could be a fascinating project.
Abbot Christopher, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Philip.
Father Christopher Jamieson is the former head of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey, where the monastery TV programmes were made, and author of Finding Sanctuary, Monastic Steps for Everyday Life. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.